Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Scott Miller from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. He's been working there since 1989. He serves as the director of the museum's Registry of Holocaust Survivors. That is an information center on survivors and victims of the Holocaust. Before that, he served as the academic and university programs coordinator for the museum's research institute, as well as research historian for the museum's Wexner Learning Center, which is a multimedia information center on the Holocaust. Also, since 1997, he's been involved with the museum's project to trace the fate of passengers who sailed on the refugee ship, the St. Louis. And, in fact, he will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. Next week, he'll be giving the third annual Samuel and Sheila Goldberg lecture on this very topic, the search for survivors, the fate of the St. Louis passengers. And this will be taking place on Tuesday of next week, the 16th, 7:30 in the evening at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And so people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, of course, should feel welcome. But we're pleased to have him here on the program so we can, in a sense, give you a preview and also discuss the topic for those people who wouldn't actually be able to attend his talk. Just a little bit more about him. He's a doctoral student in the Jewish History Department of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem and has taught in the Jewish Studies program at American University in Washington, D.C., and he is joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, that's another way to think about it, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Miller, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. Or perhaps that's an honorary doctorate I think I just gave you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Miller.
First one.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it. Just maybe to start, we could just acknowledge the fact that the museum, as well as its name would suggest, has functions not only as memorial and as educational institution, because it is part of its mission is to teach about the Holocaust for those people who visit there, and also online and through educational programs. But it does also have this research function as well, sponsoring and carrying out a lot of research about the Holocaust as well.
Absolutely. We have at the Holocaust Museum the Center for Advanced Holocaust Studies, which currently houses one of the largest Holocaust archives in the world. We have a photo archive, film archive, oral history collection, and as well the Registry of Holocaust Survivors, which attempts to document the fates of those who experienced the Holocaust, both survivors and with increasing frequency victims, visitors coming to the museum searching for information on family members, people doing genealogical research. Occasionally people need information for claims, the Swiss bank suits and other, they need documentation for many of the other legal issues that are occurring right now around Holocaust survivors.
And this effort's been underway now for about 20 years, I think?
The Holocaust Museum itself was mandated in 1980, the Congress voted unanimously to build a memorial to all the victims of the Holocaust here in Washington, D.C. The museum itself opened in April of 1993.
Mm. And I guess what I was thinking about was the registry.
The Survivors Registry, itself began actually before the museum. It was called the Benjamin and Vlatka Mead American Gathering of Holocaust Survivors, which was based on two gatherings in the 1980s, one in Washington, D.C., one in Jerusalem, Israel, that is gatherings of Holocaust survivors. And at that point, Benjamin Mead, himself a survivor of the Warsaw Ghetto, made a database out of the based on the attendees of these conferences. And the museum inherited that database and now has expanded it, and we have registered with us about 175,000 survivors and family members, and we help facilitate searches for people coming and looking for lost relatives, and we've been able to reunite family members across the ocean in some cases.
How exactly do you go about doing this work?
Well, we are first, we have launched a grassroots campaign to search for survivors or for anybody who has information on survivors, and we ask them to register with us. This can be done through the mail. This can be done, of course, via our website, museum newsletter. We are also trying to collect in any fashion, whether it be microfilm, electronically, lists of survivors, lists of victims that exist in archives around the world, in Yad Vashem in Israel, and dozens of archives in Western Europe. And now we've benefited from the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the communist world, because now there are literally thousands, if not millions, of pages of Holocaust-related material that have been that were sequestered in Soviet archives, communist archives, for 50 years that are now open to the West. So it involves an international search for lists, for names, for individuals. That's the story, specifically the angle that the Survivors Registry is trying to tell, of what happened to the individuals during the Holocaust. And through learning about the stories of the individuals, one can, I think, better appreciate the enormity of the loss, of the greater story of the Holocaust.
Are there still significant numbers of people who are essentially unaccounted for?
In terms of Holocaust survivors and victims in general, sure there are. Depending on the circumstances of, particularly the case of victims, of their deaths, for example, over 1.5 million Jews who were killed in the Soviet Union by the Einsatzgruppen and by the mobile killing squads, the Nazis did not keep name lists in terms of those killed. They often kept number lists that they would go into a town in Eastern Europe and they would list that on a given day they killed 2,020 Jews, let's say, but they were not by name. So to find information on individuals killed under those circumstances are more tricky. There are more gaps. So not every single person is yet accounted for. That's one example. So clearly not every name can be accounted for. There is somewhat of a myth or oversimplification concerning the tidiness of Nazi records. In fact, they were not complete.
There are gaps. I guess that refers to the perception that people have that the Nazi administration were almost obsessive in the way that they kept records, and records of that made it possible then to go back and reconstruct a lot of what they did.
And their records were good, but not perfect and not complete, especially in the case of individual names.
Let me introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Scott Miller. He's director of the Registry of Holocaust Survivors of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. And also for a number of years, he's been the co-director of the museum's project to trace the fate of passengers who sailed on the refugee ship, the St. Louis. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he'll be talking about that project when he visits the campus of the University of Illinois next week on Tuesday. So people who are in and around town could certainly hear from him. But he's here to talk about some of the same sorts of things with us here this morning, as I said, as a way of a preview, and also for people who wouldn't be able to attend the talk. So, and questions also are welcome if people want to join the conversation. That's certainly possible. We just ask people to be brief just so we can keep things moving along. But anybody who's welcome to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. And we do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Some people may indeed be familiar with the story of the St. Louis, but I expect a lot of people will not. Perhaps you can give the basics on that.
Yes, in broad strokes, the SS St. Louis was a ship with over 900 Jewish refugees that set sail from Germany in May of 1939 and was denied entry into both Cuba and the United States, and hence was forced to sail back to Europe on the eve of World War II. There were, to be exact, 937 passengers. Almost all of them were Jewish, left Hamburg on May 13th. 1939. Most of the passengers had to pay a lot of money to get a ship pass and also to get a landing permit to land in Havana, Cuba. For most of the passengers, landing in Havana was just a way station until they could get into the United States. Almost all the passengers had, in addition to this Cuban landing permit, had what was called a waiting number, a U.S. waiting number, and that was to make the American quota. There were the United States had very restrictive immigration policies in the late 1930s and 1940s, and if you didn't make the quota for a given year, you were given a number, and you had to wait till your number came up to make the quota. So most of the St. Louis passengers, in fact, had their American waiting number, and their intent was to wait in Havana until their U.S. number came up. However, much to the surprise and shock of the St. Louis passengers, they were denied entry into Cuba. To this day, it is not clear exactly what happened. Their landing permits were invalidated. It is known that these permits were purchased from a corrupt Cuban immigration official in Germany who had profited from the sale of these landing permits. Of the reason for the denial of the entry into Cuba is, in fact, attributed to the corruption in the Cuban government. There was also growing pro-fascist, anti-Semitic, anti-immigration sentiment in Cuba. Cuba had a relatively generous policy in terms of admitting Jewish refugees from Europe. So much of what happened with the St. Louis was just the unfortunate timing that it came at a time when xenophobia was on the rise in Cuba. And the St. Louis was a particularly large ship. It was, again, 937 passengers. 28 passengers out of the 937 were allowed to land in Cuba. There were six non-Jewish passengers, four of whom were Spanish nationals, two were Cubans, who happened to be on the St. Louis and were, of course, allowed to land. And then there were 22 Jewish passengers who, back in Germany, either had a premonition or received some type of information that their landing permits, that the Cuban landing permits might not be enough, and they paid more money to get actual Cuban visas, and they were allowed to disembark. Hmm. There was another passenger, I should add, slit his wrists and jumped ship, a passenger named Max Lowe. He was so desperate not to go back to Germany. This was a passenger who had fought in World War I for Germany, who had received the Iron Cross for bravery for his homeland, which was Germany, and who was on the St. Louis limping and black and blue because he had been interned briefly in a concentration camp at the end of 1938. He jumped ship and was hospitalized in Cuba. There was another passenger who died en route to Cuba from old age and was actually buried at sea. So there were we're talking about now 906 passengers who left Cuba at the beginning of June 1939, sailed to the coast of Miami, believing that America would let them in. One, because it was America, and what America means now to people was what it meant then, that it was the land of the Statue of Liberty, of immigration. And also remember that these passengers actually had American U.S. waiting numbers to make the quota. They had done their homework, they had done their paperwork, and there was a belief that America would let them in because they were America-bound anyway. They were not a random group of huddled masses. They were America-bound refugees with the right paperwork. But in fact, that did not happen, though they were very close to the coast of Miami. Many of the passengers who survived will talk about how they could actually see the palm trees and the lights from the hotel. They were denied entry into the United States. They had cabled the State Department and the White House asking for permission to land. They received no response from the president, although they did receive a response from the State Department telling them that they could not land until their waiting numbers came up. And it said in the actual, and I'm quoting from the actual telegram from the Department of State, saying that the passengers must await their turn on the waiting list. Hmm. So the ship had no choice but to sail back to Europe. And as you can imagine, panic ensued on the ship. Fortunately, at least for the short run, while the ship was en route back to Europe, ostensibly to Germany, due to the intervention of the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee, an agreement was brokered with four Western European countries other than Germany to take in the passengers. And these three countries were Belgium, France, Holland, and England. And when the St. Louis landed in Europe, the passengers actually disembarked in Antwerp on June 17, 1939. They were divided between those four countries. And there was much jubilation, and at that point in history, that was seen as the happy ending to this this perilous journey. However, now with hindsight and retrospect, we know that for the three-quarters of the passengers who were on continental Europe, who were in Belgium, France, and Holland, their fate as Jews was sealed in May of 1940 when Western Europe was invaded by the Nazis. And again, one more time, these Jewish refugees were under Nazi rule. Mm. And the fate of these individual passengers remained really a mystery for over 50 years. The press coverage and the St. Louis incident received much press coverage at the time, but the press coverage stopped when they disembarked in Antwerp. That was considered the happy ending to the story.
Now, this was 1939, so this was before the United States entered World War II.
Yes, it was.
But
I should add that this was after Kristallnacht in November of 1938, which was the systematic burning and destruction of synagogues throughout Germany, Austria, and parts of Czechoslovakia, the looting of Jewish stores and businesses, the beginning of deportation of Jewish men to concentration camps. And many of the St. Louis male passengers were deported in November of 1938 to concentration camps in Germany and were only released on the condition that they would emigrate, that they would leave Germany. And I bring this up because at the time, the American government was very aware of Kristallnacht. This was the headlines in American newspapers. And it did cause a strain in American-German relations already back in 1938. So while America was not at war with Germany, America was very, very well aware of what was happening to Jews in Germany.
I guess one of the things I'm curious about, you talked about the fact that it got a lot of press coverage in the United States. The nature of that coverage, particularly any editorial comment on that, and whether the judgment was that this was a terrible thing that the United States had turned these people away, or was opinion on that somewhat mixed?
Opinion was mixed. I have not, with the exception of a newspaper in Virginia, I believe it was, I have not found a newspaper editorial that said that the United States government should take in these refugees right away. However, to be fair, and on the other hand, almost all the editorials expressed sorrow at what happened and were not defensive of American policy. It expressed profound sorrow at what was happening to these refugees, but none of them actually recommended that they be admitted immediately. And much of the blame in these editorials were on the Cuban government, because that was the government, of course, that initially denied them entry. But the coverage of the St. Louis sailing off the coast of Miami was the headlines in newspapers throughout the United States.
I believe that it was the case at that time in Cuba that there was a fairly significant Jewish community, people who had actually come originally from Europe and settled in Cuba.
Yes,
were they not in any position to do anything about this?
I wouldn't say they were not in any position. In fact, it's a little known story that there was a Jewish community protest outside the president's house, the president's residence in Cuba, protesting the denial of denial of entry of the St. Louis passengers into Havana. So there was a protest, but again, this was pitted against the growing and much more significant pro-fascist and anti-immigrant sentiment that was growing. But again, they were in a position, and in fact, they did protest.
The as you mentioned, what happened when the St. Louis had to turn around and go back to Europe, that there was an agreement reached that the people, rather than having to go back to Germany, they were divided up and they went to four places, to France, to Britain, to Holland, to Belgium.
Right.
And I would expect, and you have now made an effort to try to find out what happened to them.
Yeah,
I would expect
each and every passenger, yes.
The people, and I expect that the people, by and large, the people who went to Britain managed to, they did survive the war.
The passengers who went to Britain, as far as we know, everyone survived the war. However, there were, in fact, two passengers who left Britain in late 1939 who were Romanian-born and went back to Romania. We subsequently found out through the International Red Cross that they did survive the war, but it was clearly conceivable that they would not have survived as Jews in Romania during the war. So we did, while we assumed that the British passenger survived, we still tracked their fate one by one because we had to be sure that they either, you know, they all stayed in England, or if they went back to Europe, that they if they went back to the continent, that they survived. So we did attempt to track their fate as well. And I should also add, in terms of the passengers in Britain, it was very interesting. It was quite an irony that many of the passengers who went to Britain were interned by the British government because they were considered to be enemy aliens, because most of them were born in Germany and they were considered to be German. And many of the men were put into labor camps in England. So their story and their saga is not uninteresting, but clearly the heart of what we were tracing were the fates of the passengers who went to the continent.
Mm-hmm. And what do you know about them?
We know that their fates, in a sense, and very tragically, because remember this was a group of passengers off the coast of Miami in 1939, their fates, in a sense, were reflected those of other Jews during the Holocaust. It was, in a sense, a microcosm of the Holocaust. Over 250 were deported mainly to Auschwitz, but also to the Sobibor camp, as were many other Jews in Europe, millions of other Jews in Europe. There were many who were able to escape. For example, there was an escape route from France over the Pyrenees into Spain and get ships to the United States. There were many dozens who survived in hiding, many posed as non-Jews, as Christians during the war. So again, the gamut of experiences, of Holocaust experiences, were played out with these passengers as well.
Some of these people actually managed to make it back to and gained entry into the United States?
Yes. In fact, the majority, about 60% of the passengers, actually survived the war. And this is actually a very interesting statistic. And again, I constantly refer you and the listeners back to the fact that this group of Jewish refugees had waiting numbers to get into the United States. And the irony here is that many of their waiting numbers, the waiting numbers of these passengers, actually came up, some as early as late summer 1939, going into 1940, 41, and in some cases even into 1942. They were able to get out. But the irony here is that there were many, dozens at least, where their waiting numbers came up as they were on trains to Auschwitz. So the fact that most survived because they had waiting numbers does not diminish from the tragedy. In fact, in my opinion, it accentuates the tragedy and the irony here. And I think forces one to ask the question, could not the United States government have been somewhat more flexible, even within its own procedures, bureaucratic regulations, in terms of this particular group of refugees, because they were all America-bound anyway?
In assigning those numbers, did the U.S. government, was this simply a matter of people were given numbers in the order that they applied, or did they look at, so it was just a matter of first, you know?
Mainly, in this case, it was order of application. Most of the overwhelming majority of passengers on the St. Louis would in no way have been conceived of as to be public charges, for example, on the American populace. This was a very employable group of people, middle class, upper middle class, very educated. Quite a number of musicians were on the St. Louis and artists. So in this case, it was an issue of the order of application.
And there are still some people that are an open question. You don't know what happened to them?
Yes. In fact, at this point, there are only 9 for whom we have little to no information and for whom we do not know their fate. There are a few among the 9 for whom we have some leads, some clues, but we don't know for sure. We do know the fates of the other passengers, which would be 928 passengers. We do know their fate. This was, of course, after a 5-year effort. This began in the spring of 1996, when it was decided to, by my colleague, the former director of the Survivors Registry, Sarah Ogilvy, when she conceived of the notion that it might be possible to take one event in the Holocaust, and in this case it was the St. Louis, and to try to trace the fate of every person embroiled in that event, involved in that event, and to tell the full story by telling the individual stories. And, of course, that's the premise of what the Survivors Registry is all about, telling the greater picture by telling the individual stories. And so we took the saga of the St. Louis, also because of its prominence in American society, also because it's really a part, in a sense, not just of Holocaust history, but it's a part of American history as well. It's a high-profile story, and we systematically began to trace the fate of every passenger. In many cases, we could do this by using traditional archival documentation, but after a while, we realized that this cannot be done by archives alone or by documents alone, that our emphasis shifted away from searching for documents to searching for people, that there are people out there who can tell us what happened to the St. Louis passengers, not just documents. And hence we wrote to Jewish communities all over the world asking if there is a St. Louis passenger among them. We launched a media campaign in where we read or published our list of missing passengers, asking people to contact us if they have any information. And in this age of electronic mail and the internet, often within seconds of publication of an article or broadcast of from the radio, we would receive information from people all over the world. If I could quickly give you one example.
Sure.
In fact, this was our first major breakthrough. There was a family of 3 on the St. Louis who were unaccounted for, a family named Fink. That was the family name. The father was Manfred Fink, the mother Herta Fink, and they had a 5-year-old son, Michael Fink. We did not know what happened to them, and we published our list of missing passengers in a newspaper in Israel, actually a German-language newspaper in Israel, which caters to the German-born Jewish population in Israel. And this was in April of 1997. And within minutes of publication of that article, I received an email. Dear Mr. Miller, my name today is Mikhail Barak, but in 1939 on board the St. Louis, it was Michael Fink. I was 5 years old at the time. And in the email, Michael Barak, then Fink, passenger Michael Fink, went on to tell me that he and his mother survived in the Theresienstadt ghetto in Czechoslovakia, though his father was deported from Auschwitz and died. He never saw him again. After the war, they immigrated to Israel, where they have been living ever since, and the mother had died just a few years earlier. But see, here was a case where we had to go out to look for people rather than documents to tell us the stories, because in this case, this was somebody who changed their name from Michael Fink to Mikhail Barak. So when we looked on name lists and in archives all over the world, we were not looking necessarily for the correct name of the person today. So for example, we could do this electronically. We went to look in phone books all over the world to see if there was any Michael Fink. However, we should have been looking for Mikhail Barak. So we were fortunate enough to be able to use the press, which could reach the largest amount of people in the smallest shortest amount of time, to help us. So it was really people, not just documents, not just archives, but people who were able to help us trace the fate of the passengers. And as I said, we're down to 9 missing passengers, and at some point over the broadcast, I would just like to take a few seconds to read the list, the remaining 9 unaccounted-for passengers, with the plea, with the request that if anybody has information to contact me at the Holocaust Museum.
Sure. Well, why don't you do that right now?
Okay. I will do it. These are the names of the nine, and then I will give you my telephone, fax, and email. Magdalena Ball, Anna Goldbaum, Tony Mischkowski, Rosalie Moser, Kurt Rebenfeld, Margareta Ratholtz, Arthur Siegel, Lotte Sternluch, Fritz Zweigenthal. If anybody has information on the fates or any biographical information on these passengers, if they could contact me, Scott Miller, at the Survivors Registry of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. My telephone number is 202-488-0495. My fax number is 202-314-7888. And my email address is smiller@ushmm.org. And the address in Washington of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is 100 Raoul Wallenberg Place, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20024. Again, if anybody has any information on any of these passengers, to please contact me.
And that's is that that information, those names are available on the website, the museum website?
Yes, the museum website, which is www.ushmm.org.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. We're speaking with Scott Miller. He's director of the Registry of Holocaust Survivors at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. He's worked there since 1989. He's also the co-director of the museum's project to trace the fate of the passengers who sailed on the St. Louis. And in fact, we'll be visiting here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about that project next week. He'll be giving a talk. This is the third Samuel and Sheila Goldberg lecture, talking about the search for survivors, the fate of the St. Louis passengers. And if you're interested in attending, this will take place on Tuesday, 7:30 in the evening, at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. And I'm sure that anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Otherwise, questions, comments certainly are welcome as well. All you need to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. In addition to his work at the museum, Scott is a doctoral student in the Jewish History Department of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's also taught in the Jewish Studies program at American University in Washington, D.C. Right back at the beginning of the program, we talked a little bit about the in fact, we were talking about the fact that the museum is involved in various kinds of research projects, but it is also an educational institution.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things I guess I was kind of struck by, I was just looking for some material, and I just came across an article that was published in back last spring that was just about the fact that that the museum has done some special tours of special groups, particular groups of people, and at this one, and I gather there have been others. This was a group of police officers,
right,
who were toured as a group in the museum, and the point there, obviously, of this was to serve as an example, give them into something to think about the potential abuse of police power.
Right. Issues such as, for example, racial profiling.
And I was just, that made me curious about different groups of people other than just perhaps groups of students, and I'm sure that there are lots and lots of them, different groups of people who you might not exactly think of as touring in a group like that, like police officers. I'm just curious about other sorts of, what sorts of people and groups like that come to them, to the museum.
Right. We've had groups that really reflect the gamut of professions in the United States, that really every profession, I think, can observe or feel some type of connection to the event, because in fact of the Holocaust, because in fact every profession or almost every profession in German society in some way contributed to the Holocaust. I'll give just a few examples. For example, lawyers and judges. There was a very rigid legal system in Germany in the 1930s that most of German racial ideology, or almost all of racial ideology, was in fact legislated into law, was put into law by the Reichstag, by the German parliament, that was enforced by judges. So the legal profession in Germany in the 1930s had a hand in the destruction of the Jews. Hence, we do have a lot of attorneys, judges who come to the Holocaust Museum to learn, and to learn about what happened the events of 50 years ago. And I think it can help them to look at their own profession in a different perspective. Doctors, the medical profession, Nazi science, Nazi medical experiments on Jews and on the handicapped. We have many doctors who come either individually or as groups to this museum to see how medicine can be abused as well as it can be used. And the list, of course, goes on. Educators, teachers. We have in display in the Holocaust Museum the school books that German students, elementary school students, learned from in the 1930s, and the images of Jews that these books portrayed. Okay, again, this was something being facilitated by educators in Germany in the 1930s. So teachers, when they come to this museum, can observe something that perhaps makes them look at their own lives and their own professions in a different way. So I think this is somewhat unique among museums here in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. is the way that it can relate to various professions and individuals who otherwise may not have any historical or familial connection to the event of the Holocaust. But because it was such an all-consuming event in German society, the various professions, such as you mentioned, the policemen, come here as individuals or in groups to learn.
I'm curious offhand, do you know the number, how many people have visited the museum during the time that it's been open?
Right. It's about 2 million visitors a year. So we've been open 8 years. It's about 16 million visitors. I would add the majority, over 80% of the visitors, according to visitor surveys that we conduct, are not Jewish visitors. And I bring that up because a lot of people ask, or sometimes they'll assume, well, aren't most of the people Jewish, which of course would be physically impossible as there are not 16 million Jews in the United States. Most of our visitors are in effect the same visitors who visit the other museums here in Washington, the Air and Space Museum, the American History Museum, the Science Museum. We reach out to mainstream America and the varieties of people who live in this country. But as I indicated earlier, with, I think, a special touch or a special connection to their individual lives.
Some people, I gather, there must have been some discussion at the point where we were talking about in this country building and creating the museum. Some people might have said, is it odd that here in the United States we're talking about a Holocaust Memorial Museum? One might not be surprised that, oh, say in Germany, there would be a Holocaust Memorial
right.
Museum. But why here?
Right. I should add that in the meantime, there is a Holocaust Museum in Germany, but that was a question that was asked, and a very valid question throughout the 1980s. Why here? Because, in fact, Americans were not the perpetrators of the crime of the Holocaust and were not victims of the Holocaust, nor were they collaborators with the Nazis. However, there is another category of behavior, and this is something that is highlighted here in our museum, and that is that of bystander. And then, unfortunately, the United States and many other Western democracies played the role of bystander during World War II, and that is not taking action is, in a sense, a form of action. It is a behavior, and the role of bystander is something that, as I said, is emphasized in this museum. Also, on a more political or, I would say, philosophic note, when one leaves the Holocaust Museum and walks across the street, one can see the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, the White House, the Capitol. There's some places where you can cross the street and stand and see all those at once. And it really, when one leaves this museum, I think one can appreciate those institutions more. And it could also make one realize what could happen if those institutions become fragile, or if those institutions don't do their work, or don't do their jobs, or we take them for granted. What can happen when those institutions fail us, or are absent, as they were in a country like Nazi Germany? Also, the mall, our national mall, really is not just about American history in the narrow geographical sense. The mall in Washington, D.C. is about Western civilization, of which America is a center. One goes to the various museums, the Air and Space Museum, which is about international, which is in a sense an international science museum, the gallery of African art, Asian art, the National Gallery, which again is international art from all over the world. We're about Western civilization, primarily the triumph of Western civilization and all that our civilization has produced. The Holocaust Museum is the place on the mall where people learn about the failure of this same civilization. It is related to all the other museums. It's the flip side of the other museums, in a sense, and it would be negligent, I think, on our part, and when I say our, I mean the American people, the United States government, not to talk about, not to address publicly in a public space the failure of the West among the many, many, many triumphs with which we're blessed.
We're into the period here. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left, I guess. I just want to remind people who are listening that if you have questions, comments, you want to be a part of the conversation, don't wait till the very end. You can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel. Even for people who are listening on the Internet, 800-222-9455. And again, our guest this morning is Scott Miller. He's director of the Registry of Holocaust Survivors at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, and has also been involved with their academic and university programs there at their research institute, as well as an historian for the Wexner Learning Center, which is a multimedia information center on the Holocaust. And he'll be here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about some of this, some of these same subjects next week on Tuesday. You know, one thing I want to ask you about it, and this may seem a little bit far afield, but I would think that you would, because you're associated with the museum, you would have some thoughts about this. And that is just generally how it is we approach the subject of the idea of creating a memorial to document a horrific event. And the thing I'm thinking about is what happened a month ago yesterday.
Right.
People, I'm sure, around this country and particularly in New York City are thinking about the need for something to mark what happened and to acknowledge all of those people who died.
Right.
And it seems like a difficult thing, even just to approach the idea of how it is you do that. I wouldn't even know how to start. In your mind, is there any way, based on, you know, the fact that you're associated with the museum, that you can talk about how one would even start thinking about such a thing?
Well, I can talk about the start. You have to, looking back at my experiences here with the museum, and this applies to commemorating any other tragedy, whether it be the events of September 11th or the Oklahoma City bombing, is that, in a sense, you have two stories to tell. You want to tell the story of the perpetration of the crime, what happened, who perpetrated the crime, how it happened, so the public will be aware, so it'll be public awareness. On the other hand, you want to commemorate the individuals, the victims who were involved as well. And that's the tightrope that you have to walk between telling the story of the perpetrators, but also telling the stories of the victims and the individual stories of the victims. And then, especially in terms of memorialization in the United States, you want to end with some type of hope. I alluded to this earlier when walking out of the Holocaust Museum, and you could see the institutions of American democracy, that there is still some hope. And I presume with the memorial that will be, in terms of the September 11th bombing, how do you take an event that was just so horrific and end in hope?
I hear what you're saying. That's got to be the great contradiction, that on the one hand, it's a place, it's essentially a place that's about mourning.
Right.
But how is it that you also do that and make people, in a sense, experience both of those contradictory emotions?
Right, the mourning and the hope.
Yeah.
Right. Some of this has already been alluded to in terms of the behavior of individuals, the rescuers, the firemen, policemen, and other city officials, and the renewed introspection, patriotism, people, unity in this country. All this has already been spoken about, even before people were speaking about what type of memorial, the hope that has come out of this. It's been spoken of from that very day on, actually. So it is, though it is contradictory, it is also, I think, a natural contradiction. It's natural. People begin talking about the hope right away.
We have a couple of minutes left. We have a caller in Champaign. We'll bring them into the conversation here on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I'm just curious. You know, there's, you know, a whole industry of Holocaust deniers out there.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how do they respond? How do they work into their theory the huge mass of documentation and everything else that you have at the Holocaust Museum?
Right. It's a very good question. In many ways, they're their own worst enemies. Not only do not address the documentation, the massive documentation on the Holocaust that's here at the Holocaust Museum, also at many of our government's archival institutions, the many branches of the National Archives, has literally thousands and thousands of files on the Holocaust. They do not address that issue. Occasionally, they just say that all the documentation is a hoax as well, but how that could happen in the National Archives, they don't address. And not only that, they don't even address the documentation and personal testimony of those involved in the crime, the Nazis themselves at the post-war Nuremberg trials. They dismiss all of that as well. So they don't deal very well with documentation at all, and they don't address it at all.
Have they ever said that the Holocaust Museum itself is a huge hoax?
Yes. Yes. That's really, as I said, that is their way of addressing the issue. I can't stress it enough that the deniers in many ways picked perhaps the wrong historical event to deny because of the nature of the crime and the massive documentation that exists in archives all over the world. Plus, it's an event that happened 50, 60 years ago, so there are still people alive to bear witness. And I'm not just talking about the survivors themselves. I'm talking even about American GIs who can bear witness to what they found at the camps at liberation. But again, the motivation for most of the Holocaust deniers is, again, they are not, both of us, you and myself, we both correctly call them deniers. Many people call them revisionists. They're not historical revisionists. They're not historians, and they're not revisionists. They don't have backgrounds in history. Most of the deniers have, in fact, either neo-Nazi, racist affiliations, and their motivation for denying the Holocaust is not based on any type of respectable historical revisionism, but is based, in fact, on their xenophobic, racist agenda, and that's why they deny the Holocaust. But if they're not trained to combat the documentation that we have.
We're going to, pardon me for interrupting you there, Scott, but we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. I want to say thanks very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
And again, I ask the people in the Midwest, if anybody has information on any of the names of St. Louis passengers I read out, to please contact me and help us complete this project of tracing the fate of every passenger.
Very good.
Perilous voyage.
Our guest this morning, Scott Miller from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. With more Focus, please stay tuned.